the heart of it.
Roy West kicking in towards the centre. Roy's
a distinctly Tasmanian conversation.
I can feel what it will be like when Tassie plays his first game, and I just...
Towards half forward, Stewart flying over the top. Oh, pulled in a beautiful pass.
Well done from Scott. After all, Stewart has got the first goal. Has it gone?
Nichols has had the big ruck with it. Oh! Croswell!
Hello, this is The Heart of It, a distinctly Tasmanian conversation. I'm Alistair Nicholson. Well, the Australian Football Hall of Fame has 31 official legends. Despite Tasmania's modest population, four of these legends are products of Australia's southernmost state. Royce Hart is one of them. Royce grew up on farms outside of Hobart and went on to become one of the greatest centre-half forwards the game has ever seen. From hitchhiking home from training as a child to winning a premiership with Richmond whilst on national service and surviving on a diet of bully beef, Royce has led an extraordinary life. This is his Tasmanian story.
Well, I can remember the power coming on, and I can remember the Rawlings man coming round with the groceries, and I was only two or three, but I was born there, and it was a real country atmosphere. We had draft horses to clear the land, but I enjoyed it.
You were on a farm. What sort of farming was the family doing?
Just mixed farming, backed up mainly by dairy, which the milk cart used to come along at about 6 o'clock in the morning, so we were getting out of bed at four to milk cows.
What do you remember about your earliest football experiences? When did you first pick up a footy? Where did you kick it? What did you do?
I think we moved from Whiteford to a place called Orealton, which was about 5 k's out of Sorell. It's real country stuff, and I didn't have a football until I was about 8 or 9, and I only had one throughout my whole career, and I just kicked it round on the farm using the barn ceilings as goalposts, and that's how I started off. Like you talk about Bradman with his stump, I had barns for my goalposts.
Whiteford has a bit of a cricketing connection, doesn't it, Sam? There was a famous former player for the Whiteford Football Club who played some cricket.
A fellow by the name of Joe Darling, who was the captain of Australia from the late 1900s to 1800s to the early 1900s, captained 2 tours of England, and was reputed to be the best captain prior to the 48 Test side. But he... bought a place at Stonehenge, is right boarding on my grandfather's place at Whiteford.
Sam Banks, he's now flying the flag for Whiteford, playing for your former club Richmond as well. So yeah, it's produced that town.
Well, if an Australian Test captain, the Premiership captain, and now Sam Banks, he's got a bit to live up to, hasn't he? He lived just down the road from my grandfather's property, and it's an ideal place.
Royce, what do you think it is about the country experience that produces great sports people?
I think the space is the biggest thing, and like with the urban, suburban places these days, they haven't got the space to be able to kick a footy or to hit a cricket ball in the country, and that's all we had to do. I'd wait for the post to come to read the paper, but I didn't worry about the first half of the paper because that was irrelevant. It was only the sports pages. Nowadays, I look at all the paper.
You do have a bit more time these days, Royce, in retirement, I suppose, yeah. But... What do you remember about football during that era as a kid growing up? Did you have football heroes? How much did you know about the big league in Victoria? How easy or hard was it to follow footy?
Well, we didn't have any coverage of footy until probably the early 60s, when on a Monday night at 9:30 there was a half an hour of VFL replays, and I actually barracked for Geelong because they were a pretty good side in those days. But that's the only exposure we had. The state league here, we didn't have a state league, we had regional leagues, which were both very strong, and I can remember going to intrastate games, which were as good as any VFL game. And in fact, against South Australia and West Australia, would probably win about 30 or 40% of the games. That's how good Tasmania was.
Who were your early influences as a young player before you went to Richmond? Who had a real influence on your football?
Well, probably the first coach down here was a guy called Bobby Parsons, who ended up coaching Glenorchy and played for Newtown. And he was the person that that pioneered coaching. We just learnt off ourselves. As I say, being in the country and a long way from anyone, you had to teach yourself how to do things.
How did you get to footy training? How did you get around? Did the family have a car in those days? Did you walk? Did you ride?
Didn't have footy training. That was footy training. It was lunchtime and morning recess and maybe after school. There was no footy training. Except when I went to high school, we trained on a Tuesday night and the main highway to Orielton had to go through Sorrell. And my father didn't come down to Sorrell to pick me up, so I stayed at a place in Sorrell with a teammate of mine, Breton Cusick. But we used to walk about 5 k's to the main highway, then thumb a lift to Sorrell at 6 o'clock at night.
How old were you?
13.
And then
we thought nothing of it. You know, there was no danger in those days. It was just a done thing. And we would walk from Clarence High to the East Coast Road, and if we didn't thumb a lift, we'd be stuck there all night. Our parents didn't mind because they thought we were safe. It was just part of growing up.
Do you remember your first pair of football boots? You say you had one football as a kid. Firstly, do you remember receiving it and under what circumstances? And then tell me if you...
I can't remember receiving it, but I can remember my first pair of football boots were the boots I wore to school. And they used to put leather stops with nails in them. And I'd put stops in for the game on the Saturday and take them out on the Sunday and wear them to school. But that was a done thing. A lot of players didn't have any money in those days, and that's all they could do, and they'd use their school boots as football boots.
So you would literally take your school boot and hammer your stops on the weekend?
And if you didn't get it right, the nails or the tacks would come through and you'd play with it with blood coming out of your foot. And that's how it worked. And we just accepted that sort of thing. I remember going to Melbourne and I didn't have any football boots, so I went down to a sports store in Elizabeth Street, I forget the name, it was the main sports store, and bought a pair of Jenkins boots so I could go to training at Richmond.
You played in schoolboy football carnivals, did you? Can you tell me a little of your progression through your younger years into senior football and ultimately Clarence?
Well, I went to Sorrell Area School. We didn't have a high school on the eastern shore of Hobart. I went to Sorrell Area School, and in grade 5 and 6 I played in the two primary school teams, and we won 2 premierships the first 2 years. Then I went to Clarence High, and then I went to Clarence Under 19s, and I didn't play a senior game in Tasmania and was recruited at 18 by Richmond and went over and played with Richmond Thirds.
So how do you reckon Richmond, and I know Graham Richmond, the very well-known secretary, was key to this at the time. How do you think they uncovered you?
There was a guy by the name of Harry Jenkins who was a spy round the traps for Richmond, and he recommended that Richmond have a look at it. And Graham Richmond flew over on the Saturday to have a look at me play. And Harry didn't tell him that we were playing on the Sunday. So Graham went home, came round, had a talk, left the Form 4s in those days on the kitchen table, went back to Melbourne, and I signed it. And the renowned story about the 6 shirts and a suit came into being. I said I wanted those, and I got those. I signed the Form 4 and posted it back, but Graham didn't see me play. Harry recommended it.
So he went purely on the recommendation.
But Graham was probably the best recruiter of the VFL in those days and went after every player that was available. He was asked at one stage early on in the mid-60s why he doesn't go and watch Richmond play. He said, I'll go and watch them when I recruit enough players to win a premiership. And that's what he did. After the first game in 1967, I kicked 3 goals, 7, and Graham said, oh, you played okay, but you've got to learn to kick. And there wasn't a kicking coach, so I had to go out and devise a drop punt to suit myself. And I used the theory of a drop kick, just kicking the ball before it hit the ground. Because if it hits the ground and it's wet or muddy or whatever it may be, it wouldn't bounce up straight. So I just kicked it before it hit the ground. And I thought of that myself. It wasn't anyone coming to teach you. Right. And that's the way it was.
Had you kicked drop punts prior to going to Melbourne?
Yeah, but only holding it a terribly different way. It wasn't the same way as the drop kick. Every principle of the drop kick was applied to the way that I thought about it, just to kick it before it hit the ground.
practicing and organically it happened, or did you sort of theorise it and think, well, if the ball doesn't hit the ground, how did you actually come up with that?
Well, I actually came up with it because of the success of the drop kick in those days, and the only thing that could go well with wrong with the drop kick was uneven ground. So I kicked it before it hit the ground, and it was held exactly the same. Like the old drop punt was held in a manner where you couldn't control the ball from your hand to your foot. And the way they kicked the drop kick, you could do that because it had more of your hand on the ball and just kick it before it hit the ground. And that was the theory I used.
This kid that's grown up in the country on the farm, is your head spinning when you first go over to Richmond in 1965?
End of 65. Well, I went to Richmond. Graham Richmond picked me up from the airport, took me out to a place in Kew, near the Kew Junction, where a lady by the name of Mrs. Biggs had a unit, and I stayed in the unit. And I thought it was a Sunday, and I said, I was working in the Commonwealth Bank at the time, and I had to report to head office. So I said, I'll go and catch a bus and go and look and see where it is so I know what to do. So at any rate, I catch the bus, and about half an hour later, I couldn't see any sign of the city. So I went up to the driver. I said, how long does it take to get to the city? He said, we're in Heidelberg. Got it the wrong way. I had to catch it back into the city, but that's the way it was.
So as much as you were brilliant and could deliver on the big stage, were you a fish out of water in the actual city of Melbourne in a way?
Probably, but you had to be reliant. You had to do things yourself. And having lived in the country for 15 or 16 years, all my life, if I couldn't occupy myself, well, I wouldn't succeed in that area. So Melbourne was just like the country with a lot of people. No one else to help me. Didn't have any relations there. Just plonked me there and Graham said, look after yourself. And I even had to pay board. They didn't pay my board. I had to pay board and I made Mrs. Biggs happy, I think.
What did your mum and dad think about you leaving the family farm?
It was all part and parcel of it, because what happened in those days, and since I've retired, I've looked back in detail about what went on beforehand. They had the war, the two wars, the Depression, and Lord knows, and people were leaving all the time, and sometimes they weren't coming back. So Mum and Dad would say, oh, that's another one that's going, and that was the way it was. It was just accepted. At least I didn't go. At least I came back from Melbourne. A lot of people didn't come back from the war, and I don't say that lightly.
Yeah, absolutely. So you come through the lower levels at Richmond before you get an opportunity at senior level in 1967. You kicked 55 goals in your first season of senior football. How old were you then, Royce? 19.
Yeah, I kicked 3-7 3-7 in my first game. Could have kicked 10.
So what did you think? I mean, you go out there and you have the opportunity, as you say, to kick 10 in your first league game as a 19-year-old, having never even played senior football in Tasmania. Did you think that you would be able to adapt so quickly to the highest level?
Well, I was probably lucky that I was pretty good at athletics and I could do things that a lot of other people couldn't do. And running was one of the most important things in football in those days and still is. And I was an athlete at school and that helped a hell of a lot. And if I could improve my skills, I had the natural ability to be able to run.
What did some of those tough, sort of nasty old defenders in the VFL think of this young 19-year-old upstart from Tassie who was coming and dominating on the big stage?
I don't think they in those days, if you're going well and the opposition player didn't like you, they'd biff you around the ears and that was part and parcel of the things and we got used to it. But back in Tasmania, footy was the same with that type of thing. We had wet grounds down here a lot of the time and it was pretty rough and rugged and I got used to that.
What grounds do you remember playing on here in Tassie? Which ones stick out?
I remember the Belreeve Oval one Saturday morning playing the under-19s, which I won the best and fairest in the under-19s in this particular year, and there were about 500 people sitting in the sand at the Belreeve Oval. It wasn't done up like it is now. At any rate, I hear some police sirens going. I look up and there's no one in the stand. And we were playing New Norfolk. And the New Norfolk and Clarence supporters decided to have a blue out in the street. And the police came and the crowd just emptied. But that's the way footy was. It's like the goalpost being pinched up the northwest coast. That was Tasmanian football.
Yeah. So at Richmond, to play in a premiership and such a key part of it in your first year, Royce, how special was that on reflection? And I'm sure you have many wonderful memories at Richmond, but where does that one sit?
It probably sits at the top because it was about 20-odd years since they'd won a flag And I can remember the people that were around the club who'd been there. It was a bit like when they won the flag here back in 2018, I think it was, 17.
Yeah.
And they went 37 years without a flag. We went, I think, about early 20s, 22, 23 years. And the look on the people that had been around the place for a long period of time was enough satisfaction for me.
The prototype centre-half forward is how you've been described, that the perfect model centre-half forward, the way you could leap and take the high mark. Where did that come from, and when did you start doing that? At what age did you start taking those big marks?
Well, I was a high jump champion in Tasmania, and I think my record went for about 27 years. And I used to think about the high jump, and I said, most of the players that I played on at centre-half forward were much taller than me, and in those days I had the big ruckman like Len Thompson and people like that dropping back in front of the centre-half forward. So I couldn't just stand side by side. So I used the theory of the high jump, where I'd run 3 or 4 metres and then jump, and I'd jump higher. So I'd stand off where the ball was going to go and run to the front and jump, and I'd take the ball in front of the pack.
Over your right shoulder is a beautiful painting of a famous mark you took in the 1967 grand final. Do you think that's the best mark you ever took?
Well, everyone else seems to think it is. I keep saying there were plenty of others that were good marks, but that was at the 20-minute mark in the last quarter of a grand final when the scores were equal. And the ball went up towards our goals and Paddy Nagane kicked a point, but moments before that, the ball had come in and gone over the back and went down to Geelong's forward line. And the only thing between me and the ball was Roy West. And I just jumped and I sat on his shoulder and took the mark, and it went back up and we won the game. I didn't win the game, but I think I might have helped a bit.
Yeah, I think you might have helped quite a bit. 1969, you win another premiership, and this year coincides with something a lot of people would battle to comprehend today, the fact that you're on national service whilst you're also playing football. How did you balance those two things?
Well, I went to Puckapunyal for basic training and then was sent to North Head in Sydney, and Richmond wanted me to play. So I would fly back every Friday night, play, and then fly back to Sydney through training at North Head. Then I was posted to Adelaide, and I trained with Neil Curley in Glenelg and flew back each week, parked my car at the Adelaide airport and flew back on the Sunday night. I won the best and fairest, we won the flag, and I was all Australian. And I was eating army food, and a lot of it was bully beef from World War II. One thing the army did give us was a bit of discipline, and we had plenty of exercise. We used to have to go on 10-mile marches and bivouacs, all those types of things, and they added to our fitness. So even though I didn't train at Richmond, there was plenty of activity during the day.
How on earth did they let you play for Glenelg in the 1969 grand final in the SANFL as a one-off, having played at Richmond all year? And then I know you'd trained with them during the year, as you said, with Neil Curley, but how did they get approval for you just to fly in and as one of the best players in the country and prop up their grand final side?
Well, I had the option of playing in Adelaide or Melbourne. That was the rules of national service. I could have played Graham Corns, who later went on to become a commentator, and his sons are very good players. Graham Corns was stationed in Sydney, and he played in the same Glenelg side. And he would fly back from Sydney, I'd fly to Melbourne the other way. But then when the grand final, I had the option, we'd played the grand final in Melbourne the week before, and I had the option of playing with Glenelg in their grand final.
So,
and I trained with them all the year.
You weren't contracted just to one club?
No.
So Richmond was okay with that?
There's a bloke, I think, by the name of Gil Langley, who actually did the same thing in the war, who came from South Australia as a wicketkeeper for the Test side, and he ended up playing in a Essendon grand final side. So it happened more than once.
I did read that the opponents that day didn't particularly appreciate your presence on the field, Royce. Can you expand?
Well, I can't remember much about it because I got knocked out in the first 10 odd minutes, but I ended up playing out the game, and I think I had something like 20 possessions and kicked 2 or 3 goals. Alf Brown, the reporter for the Melbourne Herald, came in at half time and talked to me. I can't remember even talking to him, and I caught a plane back that night back to Melbourne. How would they be today?
You captain two premierships at Richmond in the early 70s as well. That's obviously a wonderful honour. So you're 67 first year, 69, another premiership went on national service, and two more come as captain of the Richmond Football Club. How dearly do you hold that?
I hold that dearly, but I also hold losing in 72 as being one of the big disappointments of my career. As much as you enjoy the ones you win, you really hate the ones that you lose. And I can remember Tommy Hafey after that particular grand final going missing for a couple of weeks. And he had mentioned, and years later, he said he had terrible thoughts because that's how much football affected them. And that's what football was like. Football wasn't money in those days. Football was the love of the club. And that's what we paid for, and the love of our teammates.
Fitness was a big thing with Tommy, wasn't it? What do you remember?
Oh, huge amounts of time. Tommy used to train us around the Tan, which is about 2.5 miles around the Botanical Gardens. And he would always finish in the top three or four, being not a natural runner, but just through guts and determination. And he was really big on that sort of stuff. And he wouldn't let players on a hot March night, when it was maybe over 100 degrees in those days, have a drink of water, because only weak people had water. These days, they'd die of dehydration. Tommy wouldn't let you have a drink. It was weak.
Hard taskmaster. You played for Victoria how many times?
11.
11 times.
Captain in 72, I think.
And what do you remember of pulling on the big V? I mean, speaking to you, I know how proud a Tasmanian you are, but you represented Victoria and never other than at schoolboy level got the chance to represent Tasmania, is that right?
No, I played in the, I think the under-14s or under-15s as a first rover in the schoolboys team, and that was coached by Bobby Parsons, and I mentioned to him about how he influenced the coaching side of it. But, a lot of people in Victoria regard me as a Tasmanian. A lot of people in Tasmania regard me as Victorian because I didn't play senior football here. I only played for the under-19s, and I won the best and fairest, and then went across and 2 years later played senior football. And the ultimate, apart from a premiership in Victoria in those days, and that's something that's missing today, was to play for your state. And I played in my first state game with players like Billy Goggin, Polly Farmer, John Nichols. Ron Barassi was in the side and I took his place in the side. Bobby Skilton, just players I just dreamt about sitting down on a Monday night watching a half an hour of replays, and here I was playing with them.
At the end of your Richmond career, you go on and coach at Richmond in the reserves, is that right? And then you go off to Footscray to become the senior coach for a couple of years?
Yeah, I did that. And I went there because I thought it was time for me to try and expand my theories on football. But my theories didn't relate to the talent that I had. I thought I had the good theories, but the talent couldn't carry it out. I'm not blaming them entirely, but I think that's half the battle with coaching. If you've got good players, you become a good coach.
Did you feel like you wanted to be a long-term coach, or was it something you were just in an experimental phase?
It was just the next stage in my development, because once I finished, I became a specialist coach at Richmond, then coached the seconds for a couple of years, and Tony Jewell was going along all right in the seniors, and I was approached by Footscray and I went out and coached. I actually thought, well, at that time, I think it was about 1980-odd, I thought I'd try and coach full-time, and I had a licensed grocer, so I employed someone in the licensed grocers to look after it while I was at Footscray, and I lasted 2 days and ran out of things to do, so I went back. I can't imagine now how they've got 10 or 12 assistant coaches, what they do. No wonder the game's changed.
What ultimately brings you back to Tasmania then, Royce?
Fresh air and freedom, and I think it's the best place of any place I've been to in the world. And I don't say that lightly, because before I'd left Tasmania, I hadn't even been up Mount Wellington. And I remember when I came back, Neville Oliver, who was working for the ABC, was covering the rowing at Lake Barrington, and he asked me if I'd like to go up to Lake Barrington. Now, I didn't know Lake Barrington existed. So I went up there with Neville and just opened my eyes, and after the number of times I'd been overseas looking at Tasmania, I really didn't appreciate it, and I was just really pleased to be back here.
You go back to farming, is that right? Did you buy a property?
I bought a property and adjusted a few horses and grew a few flowers and did bits and pieces of stuff, but I wasn't clearing land like they did up at Whiteford, draft horses. We didn't do that sort of stuff.
What about your involvement in football when you came back to Tasmania? Were you involved in any capacity?
Yeah, I did some work with the TFL and junior development, and we at that time had five full-time development officers, including four who were senior coaches, and I think five were senior coaches and myself, and we would do 10 clinics each per week in the schools. And as a result of that, we would recruit, the AFL would recruit between 5 and 10 players per year through the draft. Now that dropped off, and so did the junior development and such like, and so did the players going to the AFL. And if we had five go to the AFL, it was a bad year. And I think coaching at junior level is a big thing that Tasmania's got to get back to.
You said just before that you felt like some people in Tasmania felt like you were a Victorian. I've never heard that expressed, and I certainly see you as being a great Tasmanian. How do you perceive yourself, Royce?
Oh, Tasmanian number 1, 2, 3 and 4.
What would have happened if Tasmania had a team in the big league in the mid-60s? What would you have done?
I'd have played for Tasmania. There'd be no doubt about that.
Well, the licences have been granted, and I know you were interviewed many times that day when the announcement came through. Can you sum up how you felt when that decision came?
Well, I thought that should have been done 20 years ago. We should have been one of the inaugural people into the AFL, and we should have been in early on. So when it came through, all I said was about time.
But you obviously think it's a great thing.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about that. No doubt about it. As long as we can retain the Tasmanian image, and we have to have players, there must be a moratorium on the number of players that go in the draft from Tasmania, and we have to retain 3 or 4 of the top players from Tasmania for the first half a dozen years so we can establish a Tasmanian team.
Do you feel like Tasmanians are inclined to identify and connect with and support their own?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Like, suddenly Tasmania can come into the national competition and it's organised correctly, and the players start flowing through from the state, home state, into the Tasmanian AFL team, it'll go back to what it was like 50 years ago. I can remember listening to, I think it was the 1960 win up at York Park. I remember listening to that in the radio, and the game that we beat Victoria at North Hobart, I was commentating on. So I was involved with both the wins against Victoria, and that was a really special thing. And if we can keep doing that, when we get into the national competition, we'll be all right.
Yeah, people will love it, won't they? Just a couple of quick questions, Royce. There are so many areas of your career that we just don't have time to explore. I wanted to make this conversation largely about your Tasmanian experiences, your childhood, and a few other aspects of football. But just a couple of quick, short, sharp ones. Now, people have answered this question with your name, but what do you say? If you couldn't name yourself, who's the greatest Tasmanian footballer in your mind?
Well, I knew Darryl Baldock and Ian Stewart really well, and Peter Hudson. The three of those were the three best, and to try and distinguish between the three of them, I'm not going to be put in that position.
All right. The best Tasmanian footballer you ever played with?
I suppose you'd have to say Ian Stewart, because I played in the Premiership with him. I remember when he came to Richmond and swapped for Billy Barrett, who played in the 67 and 69 Premiership sides and was a star player. He came to Richmond, and my brother actually played with him with McElwyn under-19s. And I had known Stewie briefly from that period of time, and when he came to Richmond, they said, you can take Ian Stewart around the tan, as I was saying, Tommy Hafey's tan, 2.5 miles. Stewie couldn't run round it. And he's a double Brownlow medalist, couldn't run round the tan. He ended up the next year winning the Brownlow medal, and he was just that dedicated with his skills. He said, I can't get to the ball every time because I haven't got the stamina of other players. So he just worked that hard on his skills that when he got to the ball, he got it 90% of the time.
Yep.
And that's really how good he was.
If you could have one pick across the AFL men's competition at the moment, and I know you watch that very closely, who would you pick to play for Tasmania? If Tassie, let's say Tassie was coming in tomorrow.
It would obviously have to be a forward, because defenders only save games, forwards win games. The guy who's playing full forward for St Kilda seems a fair sort of a player.
King,
he's what, a 6 foot eight, 6 foot nine full forward who can take a mark and kick a goal. I look at the way sport's going these days and I feel a lot of the sides in all sports try and save the game and not win the game. As Dennis Pagan used to say, who coached North Melbourne to premiership sides, it's goals per possessions, and I think that's the secret of it. And I've seen sides try and defend a 3 or 4 goal lead and then get run over because they lose a thing called momentum. What that got them to 4 or 5 goals in front, they suddenly change the style of game with all those coaches that have got nothing else to do. They try and protect the lead and they get run over. And that happens a lot of the time.
This Tasmanian Football Club and having matches around the state is going to lead to a lot of people from interstate coming in, injecting money into the economy, big crowds at games as well. If you could suggest one place that these people should visit on their travels to Tasmania, where would it be? Where's your favourite part of Tassie? Where should they go, Royce?
Well, I'm going to say Hobart because of Mount Wellington. As I said, I hadn't been up at Mount Wellington before I left Tasmania. Now I go up there as my favourite place. Plus also, we got fresh air. When I went to Melbourne, it was semi-fresh. But when I left, it wasn't fresh at all. When I came back here, opened the windows and let the fresh air in.
And lastly, can you give me a few words to describe a Tasmanian footballer? What are the characteristics from your generation or just those great Tasmanian footballers? What epitomised the Tasmanian footballer?
Oh, the biggest thing by far is when a Tasmanian in those days made a commitment to go interstate, they had to uproot their whole life and had that incentive, whereas the people born in Melbourne and such like could go home to mum and dad. We couldn't. We would go stay there until we succeeded, and I'll guarantee you the 90% succeeded, whereas the people in the cities, they could fall back on other things. When Tasmania had to uproot and go to Victoria, it was a long-term proposition.
Royce, it's been an absolute honour chatting to you today. Thank you very much.
No problem at all.
Royce Hart, Australian Football Hall of Fame legend, passionate Tasmanian. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Heart of It. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and share with other Tasmanian footy enthusiasts. I'm Alistair Nicholson. Thanks for listening.